Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Hi, Kalen. How are you? Good to see you. We have a, I didn't realize that Bailey wasn't on the board. I guess it's good to see you. Our board op, Kalen McPherson, this morning. And good morning. Welcome. We have a lot to talk about. It's been a wild 24 hours, and we've got a bit to discuss. And I have a couple of housekeeping things that I want to do. I apologize. I'm out of breath. I ran to my desk to get a Coke Zero and lots of ibuprofen. Okay, so which has nothing to do with our guests this morning. I promise you. First off, I want to welcome you to the show, remind you that you can be a part of the program by going to WAMC.org. WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear what you have to say about the issues that that we'll be discussing. Now, the big news that we announced yesterday is on Monday, the 4th of May, that is the 200th anniversary of Frederick Church's birth. So what does a public radio station do to celebrate? Well, we go to the home of Frederick Church. We go to Awana, and we do a broadcast, a full broadcast from Frederick Church's Awana, the National Historic Landmark and New York State Historic Site. And it's the home and masterwork of Frederick Church, who is considered by many to be the greatest American landscape artist. May 4th marks the 200th anniversary of his birth, and we will be there. We'll explore the creation, the creativity, the landscape, the preservation, the environmentalism, and the importance of home and gardens in the history and in the Hudson Valley. We are going to open it up to you, and we'd love for you to be a part of this enlightening morning on May 4th. We're going to be there from 9 to 11, 2 hours, 9 to 11. And man, do we have a show ready for you. We are selling tickets. All of the money, of course, goes to WAMC and WAMC on the Road. And so it's a donation. And it's WAMC.org/on the road if you want to find out. They're $25. WAMC on the Road. Put them on sale yesterday, and half of them sold. So if you want to go, I would suggest you do that quickly. We were stunned, actually. I had said 10 by 10. We sell 10 tickets by 10 o'clock, and then we sold many, many more than that. So $25, WAMC.org, on the road, and we'll be at Frederick Church's Awana. I'm not ready to do it yet, but we'll start the sun prayer in a couple of weeks. We're going to be inside regardless, but man, that is a beautiful, beautiful place in any weather, but go outside and it's just stunning. So we're hoping for a beautiful sunny day, and we'll have a great show on the 4th of May. I do hope you can join us, WAMC.org/on the road, to get your tickets for this special event. Speaking of special events, we have one tonight. Also on the road, we are going to be talking to Robert Brigham. He is a panelist on this program. Bob Brigham is a professor of history at Vassar College, and he also...
I've heard that.
Yes, he's very good. He's very good. And he hails from you're a colleague.
Yes.
He's your colleague.
Yeah, we're even on a committee together.
Oh, there you go. That's excellent. Well, you know he's from Cambridge, New York, and he has a fascinating story. He's written a book about it. We talked about it on Monday, and if you'd like to hear that interview, it's available online at WAMC.org. But he has a new book out called This is a True War Story, My Improbable History with Vietnam. And I don't want to undersell this, but it's just a remarkable, incredible story about a guy who becomes interested. He is adopted. He finds his interest in the Vietnam War and history, and it takes over his life, and he starts to teach about it, and he uses these very evocative photographs to help teach his students about Vietnam, only to find out that those photos that he has used were taken by his biological father, who he did not know existed. Wow. It's a hell of a story. Wow. We're going to be at the Bat and Kill bookstore tonight at 6 p.m. From what I hear, we were I was there yesterday afternoon for rehearsal. And in other words, looking around going, hey, where the hell are we going to put everybody? But we're expecting a big crowd. And if you need any information, just go to batandkillbooks.com. Also, if you can make it and you would like a book signed or you would like a book, they will be happy to take care of you. All you have to do is go to batandkillbooks.com or give them a call. And Connie and Heather and the other wonderful people at Bat and Kill Books will help you out. I'll be in conversation with Bob tonight at 6 p.m. And not to tell tales out of school, but I just have to say, I said this to Connie Brooks, the proprietor of Bat and Kill Books, yesterday. I said, you can tell that this is a special, amazing event because I do events a couple nights a week. My wife is going to this one.
Oh, boy.
I mean, you all, certainly you know this, Kathy, right? It's like when you actually get the spouse out, it's a special event.
That is a big one.
Yeah, it's a great, great event. So this is a true story, a true war story, Bob Brigham, and we'll be in conversation at 6 o'clock. And unlike most of them, because we did the interview on Monday, we're not taping this or anything. This is just an event we're going to be doing. So the only place you will hear this conversation is if you are with us. And so we do hope that you will join us and have a very special night. And I will just finally say that if you have not been to the Bat and Kill bookstore, it has been named by Publishers Weekly as one of the best bookstores, one of the top five bookstores in the country. And it is. It's just an amazing place. So know that as well. All right, let's get started and do the work we have to do. We have a lot to talk about, and we have a wonderful group. We have finally crafted a beautiful panel, and here they are. Bill Hammond joins us, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good morning, Joseph. You seem extra perky this morning.
I get a little shot out of a cannon.
And you haven't
sure.
even finished your sodas here.
No, I haven't. I'm it's a lot going on. We're moving some things around in the office, so I'm a little jacked by that. we have the big event tonight, and then just for overall tumult and stress in one's life is just the world at large. Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's figuring out where we are. And I love talking to you guys. So we also welcome the recently former mayor. Well, she was former mayor. But was mayor of this fine city. Kathy Sheehan, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Yeah, you seem,
yeah.
Yeah. You seem good.
Yeah.
You seem good. You feeling
good.
Better?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
last time I was on, you were a little, yeah.
Well, I had some kidney stones.
Yeah.
I do have to have those removed.
Ooh. Okay.
So I have to go through a procedure, but we'll.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to divulge HIPAA information.
In other words,
we should have talked about this offline.
In other words, I'm a human maraca because they're just shaking around down there. And eventually they got to, like, take them out. But they'll do that. And he said, do you want me to tell you how we're going to take them out? And I said, nope.
I think you should give him the fruit snacks now.
Yes. I do have fruit snacks. I come bearing fruit snacks. I had them in my pocket in case I needed to bribe my granddaughter into the car to get her to daycare this morning, and she went happily, so there are fruit snacks on the table for
wonderful.
Whoever,
for whoever needs them.
Yes.
That's great. We may need them at some point. Catherine Tan is with us, Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good. This event at the Alana House sounds fascinating. I visited it for the first time just last year.
Oh, isn't it a it's just gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It's kind of like funky and eclectic, but it's a beautiful house. And my favorite fun fact about it is there's Arabic script or Arabic-like script written in one of the rooms, and apparently it's just all gibberish. It doesn't mean anything.
Oh, artists.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to that event and having you all there, and it really will be a special, special morning. As I mentioned this yesterday, we the snow it snowed 2 days ago, but we think it's done. So we're ready to travel again. We're ready to go back on the road, and we're not taking the snow tires off the vehicles, but we're ready to go, and we're excited, and we have a whole slate of pretty great places that we're going to be going in the coming weeks and months. But you can stay tuned for that. All right. Speaking of staying tuned, let's talk about what is happening in the world, and we welcome you once again, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So, look, we had an announcement on Monday that the Iranians had until 8 p.m. Tuesday to comply with the demands of the White House, or civilization would be they would lose their civilization. And then about 90 minutes prior to that, there was a ceasefire announced. And so the words now that are being used are shaky,
fragile.
Tenuous. So, in regards to the ceasefire itself. So let me just read this from the New York Times, which I think is the best summary that I could find, and we'll turn it over to this panel. Israel vowed on Thursday to press on with its strike against Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia backed by Iran, as European officials push for Lebanon to be included in the tenuous U.S.-Iran ceasefire. Shipping through the Strait of Hormuz remained at a trickle, despite assurances from Iranian officials that they had lifted their near chokehold on the key waterway. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said on Thursday that strikes against Hezbollah would continue until full security is restored to residents of the north of Israel. The Speaker of Iran's parliament accused Israel of violating the ceasefire and said there would be explicit costs and strong responses. It was unclear whether Israel's strikes and Iran's threats would derail the ceasefire or affect talks between American and Iranian officials that the White House said were scheduled for the weekend in Pakistan. In the Persian Gulf, the United Arab Emirates said its skies were clear of aerial threats, and there were no reports of incoming fire from several other countries in the region that have fended off Iranian missiles and drone attacks almost daily during the war. The U.S. and Israel have said the two-week ceasefire does not extend to Lebanon, where the Israeli military on Wednesday fired one of its heaviest barrages of airstrikes in its war against Hezbollah. Iran and Pakistan, which mediated the truce, say Lebanon is included. So there is some question there as to what is going on. I did want to find the latest post from the president.
Are you sure?
Well, no. So, I mean, the other thing is just this from the Washington Post. This is their headline. The White House struggles to prop up the truce marked by confusion and contradictions. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt defended President Trump's threat to wipe out a whole civilization, quote unquote, as, quote, a very strong threat that led to results, end quote, specifically Iran's agreement to open the Strait of Hormuz. But as she spoke those words, at the press briefing, Iranian state media said traffic through the critical oil choke point was closed. Leavitt said that Iranians were saying something different in private and that those reports were false. In fact, 4 cargo containers and 0 oil tankers navigated the waterway since the ceasefire was announced, according to a ship tracking company. The fast-moving developments Wednesday tested the White House's ability to prop up a truce between two sides that did not even agree on its terms. The Trump administration, while claiming to have already accomplished its military objectives, is entering negotiations with the same demands as before the war, which are different than the 10-point demands that Iran has made also before the war. And yet, the president said that those are manageable for negotiation, hence the ceasefire. After Trump called the 10-point plan a workable basis for negotiations, Iranian state media released a version that was completely at odds with U.S. positions. Levitt said that proposal was different from the one that Trump considered on Tuesday. But by the time Levitt left the lectern, Iran's parliamentary speaker accused the U.S. of violating the terms she said weren't valid, casting fresh doubts on whether the ceasefire could hold and negotiations could move forward. So here we sit. Kathy Sheehan.
Well, I mean, it's been a long time since I've practiced law, but in order for there to be an agreement, the parties have to have a common understanding of what that agreement is. So I think it's pretty clear that even though we all hope that the ceasefire remains in place, that that ceasefire was not reached based on a common agreement between both sides. And it demonstrates that obviously these negotiations are challenging. They require a tremendous amount of diplomatic skill, which by all reports, the administration is not tapping into. Those people who are expert on Iran and who speak fluent Farsi and who are able to help the negotiators navigate what's really being said and what's really meant. And so here we find ourselves in what I think is a horrible position for the United States of saying that there's a ceasefire, but recognizing that the other side of that ceasefire is saying, no, we don't have an agreement. I mean, not including Lebanon is a fundamental part of the ceasefire. And if there is a disagreement on that, then we have no agreement.
The fact that there is such turmoil and confusion, Stephen Colbert, I thought very amusingly, referred to it as the fog of peace yesterday.
That phrase occurred to me, too.
Yeah, it's just we don't know what's happening. And that, to your point, Kathy, is rather disturbing because it seems like we should know.
Well, and I think it's also, again, a symptom of this president and how he leads. And that is that he has surrounded himself with sycophants who tell him what he wants to hear. And I think he clearly wanted a ceasefire after threatening a war crime against Iran. And so this clearly was either intentionally or unintentionally placed before him, declared the ceasefire, and there was not a meeting of the minds. And so it's back to the negotiating table, and it's just up. We don't know minute to minute, hour to hour, what this president is going to do in the interim. And so, you know, we're in a worse position today than we were when he made the threat. I mean, that's just my opinion, but I don't like where we are because who knows what this president will do. Mm-hmm. And clearly, again, there is no meeting of the minds here.
Yeah, it's to say that it's a 2-week ceasefire doesn't actually promise anything because Trump can turn around and take action like today, for all we know. Maybe it's happening right now. But also, as you noted, Kathy, that not having an agreement on what goes on in Lebanon is really outrageous. I feel like that is a big, big oversight there or big miscommunication there. Looking at the 10 points that they supposedly agreed on, well, first off, you know, this war should have never happened in the first place. But looking at these 10 points, the U.S., if this is what Trump agreed to, the U.S. conceded a lot from what it was that Trump said, what he wanted from this war, right? So it's saying that Iran is allowed to have a nuclear enrichment program, that we would pay for damages, and that they would maintain control over the straits, and that all these sanctions will be lifted. And, you know, it while this war should have never happened, these terms sound like the U.S. losing.
Iran coming out much stronger.
Much stronger. They're coming out with way more than what we came in with, right?
I guess I haven't seen any indication that the U.S. agreed to those 10 points.
Yeah.
Those seem to be what they are asking for in the negotiations.
They said they were the workable basis, but they were the same, from what I understand, that they're the same 10 points that were initially rejected, which allowed the war to proceed in the first place.
And now it's being reconsidered.
Correct.
The one part of the ceasefire that seems to be real is that the fire has ceased, or at least has mostly ceased, at least among two parties, right? Mm-hmm. The U.S. has not, to my knowledge, has not done any more bombing or missile attacks or drones or anything. And Iran has also seemed to pull back for the most part. The one party that hasn't ceased fire is Israel, who's like stepped things up in Lebanon. And I think they continue to be a wild card here. The New York Times had this great story about how Netanyahu came to the White House and kind of pitched the president on, you should go to war with Iran. And he had this whole plan laid out, which included like Iran becoming a democracy and like the son of the Shah maybe taking over. The president ended up agreeing to do the war. And now, like, Israel is not cooperating with the ceasefire. And it was a mistake in the first place, and they're not cooperating with the ceasefire. I don't know if they're even going to be part of the peace talks that are supposed to be happening. The value of having an agreed upon written, like we have fire has ceased, but all the rest of the world, especially with respect to the Strait of Hormuz, ships are not going to try to go through that strait unless they have some confidence that they're going to get through, like that they're not going to get blown up. And I don't think. And also they need insurance. And so the insurance companies have to figure out what's the risk to this ship and how much am I going to charge for that? That goes right into the price of whatever the oil or whatever else is going through. You need to have the parties have to publicly have a set of stipulations that they are promising to abide by. And it has to be credible. It has to, before people will trust the agreement enough to go back to some version of a new normal. At this point, it just seems like this is so much worse. The reality on the ground is so much worse than it was before the war started. We have not eliminated the nuclear program. We have not. The Straits of Hormuz are closed. The pluses that we've achieved involve weakening things that the Iranians eventually can rebuild, and especially will be able to rebuild if they have a new source of revenue from tolling ships through the strait. It's a mess.
It's a mess. And what is so enraging and devastating are the poor civilians who are being used as pawns, right? And to have Trump earlier in the week come out and say, oh, we're going to, blast them back to the Stone Ages or something like that. It's so dehumanizing, that language and just the way. And also, what I've been really upset with is just the media coverage of what is happening to the people in Iran, right? All these people who obviously, do not want to be bombed, do not want to be attacked. They also do not like their regime, and they're dying. They are being displaced, and the media coverage doesn't do much to humanize their situation. Like, you look at the way the war in Ukraine was covered, and how so much humanity was brought to the people to Ukrainians. during the ongoing war. And we don't really get those narratives about Iranians and what they're going through. Meanwhile, you know, you have all this chaos and, you know, this fragile agreement going on. And it really, I think we're really missing from this conversation and how it's being covered, like what this looks like for people on the ground.
Well, and I think, you know, we're reading that in Iran there is going to be some sort of gathering at the school where 125 mm-hmm. Plus civilians were killed, most of them children. Israel killed scores of civilians in Lebanon overnight. That's what we're being told. Mm-hmm. And bombed areas that were not known to be Hezbollah strongholds. And again, Israel is, I think, when you think about an ally in this, certainly it's very, very, very unclear why Israel chose to do what it did. Because it wasn't as though it was in response to rockets being launched, mm-hmm. although rockets were launched after Israel demonstrated that there was no ceasefire in Lebanon. And so I think the fact that Hezbollah thought that the ceasefire applied to Lebanon definitely shows that there was communication. This was something that was clearly talked about. But, you know, Israel demonstrated in Gaza that it didn't understand or have the same definition of ceasefire that most people have and that most people understand. And because of that, you know, to your point, Catherine, the human side, the human toll here, what is happening to families and children and the elderly, all of the suffering, the human suffering that is being caused by this is being glossed over by a president and certainly Pete Hegseth, who talks about lethality, who they believe that there are no restraints on who they can bomb, who they can target, what they're doing, and all of it is to the glory of the president of the United States. And mm-hmm. and that, to me, is what comes across, is that this is about him winning, him demonstrating that he is in charge. And the human toll is devastating. And again, at some point, we are going to, as a nation, have to deal with the consequences of that.
It has been reported in multiple places, including the Associated Press, but given the backlash that the president got for the rhetoric that he had used, but those in the room described, anonymously of course, described the president as bloodthirsty and like a mad dog, which we saw as a result, we saw when Power Plant Day and Bridge Day and the bombing them into submission and so forth. So, but all of that, I mean, we've talked about this in the program since the beginning of the war, about this, you said lethality, and I think, you know, the words that are being used are very important here, but they're also, again, really mixed messages, because he's also talking about, I mean, less than a week ago, he was last Wednesday, he said at the press conference, they want us to keep bombing them. They say, please, Mr. President, please keep bombing us because we want to be free. Please keep bombing us. I mean, I would argue that's unhinged, but I also think that it's a very odd ingredient to put into the equation to figure out of how we are going to eventually get peace.
The one constraint that he seems to be restrained by,
yes,
is what's going on with oil. He does not like the idea of oil becoming more expensive because of its ripple effects on the American economy and on American politics. He doesn't like the idea of the stock market going down. Stock market, when the ceasefire was signed, this stock market kind of went up, the price of oil went down. That seems to be one thing that he does care about. He may not care about civilian casualties. He may not, but he seems to care about being perceived as a good thing for the U.S. economy.
Well, but then he could have focused on affordability instead of going to war and spending over $200 billion, which we could have used to strengthen our infrastructure.
I'm not saying it's a logical system, but that does seem to be what part of his thinking. All of this seems to really, the nugget of the whole thing seems to be the threat that Iran will get a nuclear weapon. That's the thing that most worried Israel. I think it worried a lot. It worried the U.S. Nobody wanted the Iranian regime to have control of a nuclear weapon because of how destabilizing that would be, how it would change the balance of power, especially in the Middle East, but in some sense worldwide. And they thought, Israel thought, and President Trump thought, you know, the Iranian regime is weakened. This is a moment where we could not topple them and we could end the nuclear threat or at least stymie it.
But what a
in
terrible
a big way.
Strategy.
Well, I don't know what Israel was thinking through, but the U.S. definitely did not think through how it was going to, you know, what the step three was going to be. They had step one and two pretty clearly lined up. I think it completely backfired. I don't think it worked. I don't think they've eliminated the nuclear threat. From what I was reading this morning, they still have, you know, the supplies of enriched uranium. They probably still have the equipment to continue enriching it. So, and so now you still have Iran with some nuclear program and the Strait of Hormuz closed. You know, however many thousands of people have died, the effect on the credibility of the U.S. It's a mess.
Iran being politically weak before the war, there was an opportunity there to support an opposition party. There isn't one right now, clearly, but to support an opposition party, to negotiate, to take advantage of that weakness so that, so that we could negotiate something without having to go to war. And so this just seems like we know this isn't an irrational war, but it is senseless and strategically irrational to take such an aggressive move at a time when we could have gone in a lot softer and negotiate their nuclear holdings.
Let's hold it there. We're going to take a break when we come back. We have letters. We have much more to discuss. We want to talk about some other aspects of this. And all of that will happen after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Bill Hammond, Kathy Sheehan, and Catherine Tan with us this morning discussing the latest of what is going on in Iran with the war. And I mean, the simple answer is there's a lot we don't know and there's a lot of confusion and trying to figure it out. And I do think that that's been the position for the last couple of weeks. And so here we are with, I guess, a ceasefire on the table, although questions are resounding as to how long will this last? Will it last? Can it last? And that is what we're trying to get our hands around this morning. Let's go to some letters. We go to Andrew. It's hard to believe, but it would seem Trump's strategy is based on the day-to-day news cycle and what he thinks he can get from it in the short term. This two-week hiatus has just prolonged the time when the world would ultimately have clarity on the circumstances surrounding Iran and the Strait of Hormuz post-war. And again, and I know, I mean, the problem about talking about this is it seems it's repetitive when you mm-hmm. when you say these things over and over again. But I think it's important to remember that prior to the war, the Strait of Hormuz was open. So that it was closed when the war began. So and now if they're going to be if Iran is then going to be in charge, then what have we gained in this, to use the president's term, excursion?
Yeah. I mean it is a worse situation mm-hmm. than before the war started.
And the other thing is that this is what happens, I think, despite what Pete Hegseth said yesterday during his press conference, that all military objectives have been met. Well, we didn't really know what those were, and I'm still unclear. And we've had guests in on this program who said, well, the main objective was that they cannot build a nuclear bomb. Okay, but was that?
I think one of the big surprises.
The big concerns.
Yes. One of the big surprises is that the regime did not fall. They decapitated it. They wiped out the Ayatollah and lots of other leaders. The country has taken a beating. And I think they might have expected, under those circumstances, that the regime would collapse, there'd be a popular uprising, and it just hasn't happened.
But the intelligence community said that would not happen.
Right.
There were those in the room who told the president that's I realize that. But I think it's very important for listeners to understand that was never a basis to attack Iran, because it was never going to happen. This is a brutal regime that killed, by some counts, 5,000 protesters mm-hmm. not 2 months ago.
Yep.
And so the idea that this and I do believe that Netanyahu tried to sell that as an outcome that would happen. But even those in the room on the U.S. side who normally defer to the president said that is not going to happen. Yeah. It's not going to happen. And so the fact that we are ping ponging with this president all over the place and we don't know what the objectives are and we don't know what his end goal is or when this is going to stop, I think it goes back to what you said earlier. He is unhinged. This is not a well person. This is not a stable person. This is not somebody who has any business taking us into war. And it's a very scary place for me. And the more I see and the more that we keep hitting repeat with these bad decisions after bad decisions after bad decisions, let's talk about the consequences of these decisions, because I think that's where we really need to be communicating better to the American people. That, I mean, in addition to the pocketbook, right, you're paying way more for gas. Mm-hmm. The cost of materials are going up. Now the cost of delivery is going up. So you're going to see that in your food prices. God help you if you need a new washing machine. I mean, all of these things are going to be impacted by what we're seeing and what's happening as a result of this attack. And that also then impacts your municipality. So if you thought you were going to get 4 roads paved, in your community in Del Mar, I'm going to tell you, they're sharpening their pencils right now and figuring out how they're going to pave 2 roads because all of the costs of these materials have gone up. And so this is impacting people. The cost of picking up garbage, all of these things are dependent on fuel prices that looked like they were in a stable place. And so I can assure you that I know when we created our budget, we were not anticipating that we would go to a war in Iran. I think most people thought that this president, mm-hmm. to your point, Catherine, was going to be focused on affordability and was going to spend the months leading up to the midterms addressing that issue and working on ways to drive prices down. And we've seen the exact opposite of that. And that is going to impact our communities. And it's not going to just work out if this ceasefire holds and gas goes down to or remains at oil remains at $95 a barrel or goes down back down to 90, this has to work its way through the economy. Mm-hmm. And even if the Strait of Hormuz were to open up tomorrow, all of this takes time, and it's having impacts on everyday people and the decisions that they make about putting food on the table, buying medication, getting health care, and that is critically important to our economy, and all of that is being impacted by this. So this does matter. It's not over there. It is right here at our front door.
And to go back to your earlier point, like, yes, Trump is absolutely unhinged, so it's really difficult to follow or try to examine the pattern and make sense of it, right? Because there isn't a pattern other than him acting on ego and trying to present himself as this great and powerful global leader because he's bombing the crap out of people for what. But what is really egregious are the conservatives and people in his party, people in the Republican Party, who are sycophantic and still supporting this, even though we see things going off the rails. You know, yes, he is unhinged, and we should be invoking the 25th Amendment here, but there are people who are allowing him to completely spiral out of control. Where are the brakes?
I mean, it's just sort of a fact of American politics that when a president goes to war, normally what happens is the whole country kind of lines up behind him. Mm-hmm. In this presidency, he didn't make any attempt to get the country to rally behind him, but his party is definitely rallying behind him. I Kathy just said something that got me thinking. I pay attention to state government. That's what I do for a living. And I will have to say that I don't see any evidence that state government is sharpening a pencil right now. In fact, I would say it's going the opposite direction. And I think that's one of the negative effects of a situation like this is that it consumes so much of our attention and our political energy is focused on this war, and rightly so, that all of the other operations of government fade into the background. And so the decisions that are being made right now, they're settling a state budget in Albany. Getting zero attention from the public, and they're making terrible decisions. I'll give you an example. They're agreeing to a huge increase in pension benefits. That is nuts. There's no reason to do it. It's extremely expensive, and it's just sailing through because they're operating in the shadow of this huge worldwide global catastrophe. And, that's a personal horse of mine,
mayor,
I don't see any pencil sharpening going on.
But as a mayor that has to pay those bills, I can assure you there is pencil sharpening going on at the local level. I mean,
are they telling the state not to do the pension hike?
They certainly are. The state and the pension has to be competitive if you're going to hire people. And so you have to look at the benefits that you're offering and ensure that they're competitive. And you've got to figure out how you're going to pay for it. And every time there's been changes made to the pension, the impact falls to the local level. I mean, but I will say, as far as, you know, when you bid something out to contract, right? So, you know, the city of Albany, we bid out contract one and contract two for streets. If those come back over what is budgeted, streets will not get paved. We don't have a choice. So we have to balance our budget. There's the rainy day fund for most small municipalities, even large cities, is very small. And so it gets harder and harder and harder as those costs get shoved down onto the municipalities, which is why all the cities are asking for the state for more money to say, if you're going to do this, you need to give us more money in order to be able to cover that cost.
In the promotional materials for this program, we use the term wide-ranging discussion. This is a great example.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good. No. It's fine. As I said, as advertised, a wide-ranging discussion. We will continue. We have many other issues to discuss, and we will do exactly that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this break in news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Yasmin Williams, the music we are playing this morning. You can see the playlist by going to WAMC.org/roundtable. And, of course, listen to the music as we go into our breaks during the panel this morning. We welcome you. Bill Hammond is here, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. The former mayor of the city of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan, is here, and associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some letters. Stephen from Wayweyanda, New York, says, if you don't offer a fair and reasonable pension and health care plan, you will still pay perhaps more in the form of Medicaid and welfare. Then we go to Pat. As I understand it, the people who tell Trump to keep bombing us are wealthy expats who want to return to a fondly remembered life under the Shah. They don't actually live there now. They don't care that a population of Iranians actually lives there. Then we go to this letter, which very inconveniently says cannot be displayed right now. I don't know that I've ever gotten that warning before.
To that last comment, though, I think, you know, it's been said over and over again. Iran is a bad actor. They sponsor terrorism. They want to have a nuclear weapon. They have worked to destabilize the Middle East. And so, there are those who suggest that, you know, going back to life under the Shah would be phenomenal. You know, I'll remind you, there were lots and lots of bad things that happened under that regime as well. But, I think that in addition to Israel, Saudi Arabia and other actors want the United States to continue this war because it benefits them. And there is a financial benefit to them. And it also, they would love to see a Middle East with either a very weakened Iran or obviously, you know, ideally regime change in Iran.
Mm-hmm. Again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to this letter from Jason, who says, it is no argument to say that a nuclear Iran is bad, 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 bad. We all know that. We all knew that 6 weeks ago. What we don't know is what Iran has for nuclear capability now. Isn't there every incentive for Iran to get a nuclear weapon and get it quickly? And wouldn't the people in Iran now support it? Because America would not have attacked a nuclear Iran.
So one of the people have been talking about the leverage that Iran has. And just having anything that approaches a nuclear program gives them leverage, meaning they have something that other people want them to not have. And so it can be a subject of negotiation. The Strait of Hormuz was another piece of leverage that they had, and they've now exercised that. Their position in some ways, bizarre as it may seem, is stronger now than it was before the war started, especially with respect to the Strait. It was just a colossal miscalculation, the whole thing. I mean, to the extent there was any calculation at all.
We go to Dave, who says the panel focused on short-term discomfort, higher costs, and instability, but missed the bigger picture. Situations like this are more like construction, disruptive now, but often necessary for long-term stability and peace. There also seems to be convenient amnesia, quick to label the current president as unhinged, yet not long ago we had a presidency widely seen as driven by unelected staff behind the curtain with far less scrutiny.
Wasn't a great situation, but he didn't start a war.
And I think that you had people who demonstrated that they listened to experts, that they were following the Constitution, respecting the Constitution. But in any event, I think that to suggest that this somehow will have a long-term, you know, short-term pain for long-term gain, I think that is where I have yet to see someone credibly explain what that will look like and what that will be, given the situation that we're seeing now.
I mean, this is giving them and other countries a reason to develop their nuclear program and military, right? Seeing what the U.S. can do, or rather how the U.S. Doesn't have structurally a power to control an egotistical, like unhinged leader.
But I think that this is where, you know, the soft power versus military power. It, when you look over the course of history and you look at the United States, wealthiest nation in the world, a country that was seeing an economy that was growing, that you had an understanding among leaders on both the Democratic and Republican side that soft power is often far more effective than just going and bombing the hell out of someone. Mm-hmm. And we now have people in place who they want to use their powers of war and their power to destroy, to blow things up and destroy things, because it's harder to stand there and claim victory when you've won something through soft power, right? Mm-hmm. Through going and working with a country, working inside a country, working towards regime change, whatever that might be. And this is a president and a group of people who this is about their egos and lifting up those egos and having them look powerful. And it's a very different use of power than what we've seen in my lifetime, at least in this country.
I think you highlight something really important, which is how soft power and its efficacy and successes go unnoticed. It's sort of like preventative medicine, right? These are things that people don't see and it's taken for granted versus, you know, Trump likes the ostentation, like the showiness, the bigger, the better for him, right? And so when you have something like a war, you can't look away.
And I think we saw that at the local level. Again, you know, I try to bring it back to the local level when we saw a huge uptick in violence, around the time of the pandemic. And, we had programs that were in place and some people, you know, they would mock them, you know, hug a thug, or why do we have violence interrupters? Why are we hiring formerly incarcerated people to try to go and solve disputes? Mm-hmm. Because you can't see a shooting that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But during pandemic, all of those resources went away. The violence interrupters weren't allowed into the hospitals, understandably. A lot of the soft tools that we had been using to prevent violence vanished. And to me, the fact that we saw this huge uptick in violence demonstrates how impactful and effective they were. But there are those who say, I get frustrated with that. I don't want to hear about that. I want to see a cop with a gun on every corner. I want to see, you know, people's heads getting busted. And so it is this tension. And again, I think we have an administration now that it's very clear what side of that continuum they fall on.
Mm-hmm. We have this letter from Susan saying, whatever the U.S. does, Netanyahu is not going to stop this war. The longer it goes on, the longer he stays out of jail. That is from Susan. Then Peter from Saratoga Lake writes, Trump being unhinged is indeed scary. However, everyone around him who are enabling him and fail to disarm him by selling him false success and misinformation are the scariest reality. Everyone in that circle are guilty of war crimes and must be held accountable.
I think this is so this episode in American history, like going beyond the war, the Trump administration is it's sort of rewiring the country, mm-hmm. unfortunately. I mean, for one thing, it's you know, you're seeing European leaders say we will never look to America the way we have in the past because your country, your system has produced this terrible outcome twice, mm-hmm. like two times in two separate elections. It wasn't some kind of anomaly that we can ignore. We have to factor this into our relationship with the country on a long-term basis. That's one way it's rewired. And another way is that it's exposed these weaknesses in our constitutional system, where the checks and balances aren't functioning the way mm-hmm. they need to function. Ideally, you would come out of a situation like this with an amendment to the Constitution or some new safety valve. I don't know whether that's feasible in our sort of polarized politics, but that like that's the kind of thing that we need in order to go back to a stable and trustworthy country.
Well, I think to that point, it's very interesting that and it was pointed out that it was Rubio who was able to pass bipartisan legislation when Biden was president that is the only reason that this president has not been able to pull us out of NATO out of a snit or a fit.
It was a law that felt said that Congress had to approve.
Congress has to approve by two-thirds majority. And so I think that, you know, certainly the fact that there have been no profiles in courage on the Republican side that I can see holding this president accountable. You know, people are frustrated with Democrats or frustrated with Republicans, but this Republican Party has run on a philosophy that government doesn't work and they don't want it to work. And so when we look at what we're seeing out of this Congress, it's no surprise to me. It is horrifying because this president has done things that even I didn't fathom he would do when I was telling people that this was not a good idea to mm-hmm. reelect this individual. But to see this Congress continue to allow him to utter things that are war crimes, you know, threaten to annihilate an entire civilization with no checks and balances does, I think, to your point, demonstrate this is really showing that if you have individuals who decide not to do their job or do the job that was envisioned in our Constitution, then this is what you end up with. Yeah. And it's a very scary place to be.
It's horrifying that the system can be this easily compromised in just a decade, right? And that surprises the American people. That's surprising the rest of the world, that we can just descend into authoritarianism this quickly.
I mean, the idea, the Constitution did say that the president would not have the power to declare war, that the Congress mm-hmm. was. That got kind of abrogated somewhat in the 50s or 60s. But there still was the thought that, okay, if a president goes crazy and starts a war, Congress will either, you know, defund whatever the president mm-hmm. is doing or impeach the president. And that there's not even a whisper of either of those things happening at this moment.
All right. Let's go to a slightly different topic, although not really. We're still
pensions?
On.
Let's talk about pensions.
You had your time with pensions.
Tier six.
So meanwhile, while Rome burns, as Trump swings on Iran, Congress is absent and GOP leaders mum. This is an article from the New York Times. And I'll ask you, the home listener, and our panel members to decide whether it is fair or not. The Speaker of the House was tweeting about transgender athletes. The Republican senator who leads oversight of the Pentagon was promoting Trump-branded investment accounts for children. The chairman of the Maine Foreign Affairs panel in the House was posting photos of newborn bald eagles. As President Trump swung this week from threatening to annihilate Iran to announcing a ceasefire whose terms and durability remain murky, Congress, the branch of government vested with the power to declare war and regulate trade, remained in recess and largely in the dark. And its Republican leaders had little to say, even as Democrats ratcheted up their criticism, clamoring anew for a vote on military options in Iran, and even calling for the president's removal after his warnings about wiping out Iranian civilization. It was the latest instance of congressional Republicans who have deferred to Mr. Trump on matters large and small since he began his second term, ceding their prerogatives and much of their power to the White House. In this case, their relative silence also helped them avoid wading into what has become a messy intra-party debate over the war, as elements on the right criticize the president for plunging the United States into what could be a prolonged and costly conflict.
I mean, it's definitely a breakdown. It's you know, it's a check and a balance that's supposed to keep the president under some kind of restraint to put a limit on what he can do and to intervene when he does something that is, you know, just crazy, and it's just not working. It's I don't know what the answer is. I really like I think one answer, and it's kind of unsatisfying, is the midterm elections. It's unsatisfying in the sense that we have to wait, and it's not guaranteed what the outcome will be, but it seems quite likely that the Republicans will lose the House and possibly the Senate. This war makes all of that more likely. The war and the gas prices and the sense of chaos that's coming out of Washington. So then the next question will be, how strong will those majorities be? They're almost certain to seek an impeachment, but will they have enough votes in the Senate? You know, will the war continue? I think the Democrats will be in a position to shut down the funding for the war, but that's means waiting till January.
Well, and I think that again, what we're seeing is, and we can have this debate, right? That had always been the debate: how much government. Is government too intrusive? Do we have too many regulations? And that had always been sort of the point and the tension between the Democrats and the Republicans. But we have Republicans who have allowed our government to become so unstable. Mm-hmm. And they have supported this philosophy that there is no role for government, for example, in protecting the environment. I thought it was so, hypocritical to show these baby bald eagles who, under this Republican regime, would never have been protected because they don't want there to be any intervention on the part of the government. We have an announcement that was made that's horrifying to me, that apparently we're shutting down within the Forest Service any research positions. And so there are folks right now that are measuring snowpack in the mountains in Colorado because there was so little snow and it melted so early, so that we can predict what's the fire season going to be like. How are we going to ration water? What is going to happen to the reservoirs? All of these things are things that I think most people would say, that's a good thing for government to be doing. I want this information. We need to know this in order to be able to make difficult decisions about how we allocate scarce resources. And so this is a group of people, though, who are really focused on decimating that and rolling back government's role everywhere. And I think what we've lost in that is that there are places where and things that the federal government is in the best position to do and has the resources and should be working to do things like protect our environment. You know, again, the hypocrisy of make America healthy again. That means apparently breathing mercury, not caring about how much lead, is in the air and in our water, and not regulating it. So, again, that is the Republican Party that we have right now. I'm not saying that the Democrats have all the answers. And there are Democrats out there saying we can't just go back to where we were because people were unsatisfied. We weren't getting it right. We need to listen to people. We need to understand what the right balance is. But I think where we are right now with the Republicans abdicating any role of the federal government in things that most of us have come to expect the mm-hmm. federal government to be involved in is hurting our country, hurting our economy, and making us less safe.
Their power is over the purse, right? And we saw how they just surrendered that over to Trump. And we saw with the earlier big shutdown that lasted for God knows how long. You're right, Kathy. Like, what they're doing now is they're saying, well, you know, we want to reduce government involvement, but they're just letting go of the reins, which has allowed all of this to descend into chaos, as opposed to really reimagining, policies and programs and how that could impact change.
This is one area, I think, with respect to the war, this is one area where I think we can all agree that the federal government should be less powerful, or at least the executive branch should be less powerful. I think the one group of Republicans who are saying a little bit there's like an anti-war faction and there's a libertarian faction, and they haven't spoken out effectively, but it's pretty clear that they're unhappy that we're in this situation. One of the things Trump ran on was no more foreign mm-hmm. wars. And so there is a part of his base that did not want the situation that we're in now. I think they're recognizing, we were double crossed on this point. And so you can still hope that at some point they will peel away. And that they will, in an ideal world, the Democrats would be approaching those people and trying to bring them in to some kind of action. I don't know if that's happening or not.
We'll pause there. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll do the last half hour of the show. We'll continue. We have other topics to discuss. We welcome you, as we always do. You can join us and isn't this fun? It is fun. And you can be a part of it. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. None of the stuff we're talking about is fun, but, you know, it's fun to have these conversations. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation after this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this ninth day of April. And we welcome you, panel@wamc.org. Let's go again to some other topics. Again, these are all sort of all somewhat related, but NATO. Let's talk about NATO for a little bit. President Donald Trump appeared to hold back on Wednesday from taking dramatic action to reshape the U.S. relationship with NATO after a high-stakes meeting with its top leader, postponing for now the reckoning he had promised over Europe's cautious approach to his war on Iran. Why wouldn't they want to get involved in this? The White House said in advance of the meeting with NATO Secretary General, it's Rutte, isn't it? Rutte?
R-O-T-T-I.
R-U-T-T-E. Rutte?
Let's go
Rutte.
With it.
Yeah.
Rutte. All right. That Trump was playing it. And I watched him last night on Jake Tapper, and I still did not make that connection. Anyway, was planning to discuss the possibility of the U.S. exiting the alliance, a threat to the organization that for generations has been at the core of how the U.S. protects itself and its partners. But a Trump post on social media hours after the meeting made no mention of a pullout and simply repeated the president's complaint about the alliance. NATO wasn't there when we needed them, and they won't be there if we need them again. Remember Greenland, that big, poorly run piece of ice? Trump wrote, all
shouty caps.
It's exactly
the wrong thing to bring up in this context. Like, let me remind you of why you hate me so much, you know?
Well, there is that. Trump, long a NATO skeptic, has been especially angry at alliance members in... by the way, I just think it's funny to... I mean, just referring to Greenland as a piece of ice.
Okay. But it has rare earths. So.
I think if it were just a piece of ice, we wouldn't necessarily want it as badly as he wants it. Trump, long a NATO skeptic, has been especially angry at alliance members in recent weeks for declining to take part in his attack on Iran, saying they had flunked his test of whether they would support the U.S. at a time of military need. He has said repeatedly that Europeans would soon find out his response. The former Dutch prime minister, who has pursued such a deferential approach to Trump that last year he called the president daddy, has cheered the Iran war, but the campaign has strained Trump's relations with the European members of the alliance, who say the attack on Iran was both a violation of international law and bad strategy. Rising anti-American sentiment among their own voters is further limiting their appetite to defer to Washington. He said yesterday, he's clearly disappointed with many NATO allies, and I can see his point, but at the same time, I was also able to point to the fact that the large majority of European nations has been helpful with basing, with logistics, with overflights, with making sure that they live up to the commitments.
So I thought this is another way in which Trump is rewiring things, is that the NATO is a piece of paper, it's an agreement, it has, you know, it's legally binding in some respects, but it really ultimately relies on the good faith of the countries that participated. And French President Emmanuel Macron made that point very nicely in the article you were just reading. He said, alliances like NATO are valuable in what is left unsaid. That is the confidence that underlies them. If you cast your doubt on your commitment every day, you strip it of substance. It's kind of a French way of thinking about things. But what he's basically saying is that we don't trust America. We don't trust the president, and therefore we don't trust the U.S. And NATO was built on trust. It was built on the idea that if one country gets invaded, everybody responds. And that's gone. I mean, even if we don't formally withdraw, the faith that underlies NATO is all but evaporated. Going to a war in Iran was both a bad idea and they hate his guts. Like, they had more than enough reasons not to cooperate in what he was doing. And I don't know what else he expected.
But NATO does not require cooperation in this instance. And I think that is where this president is trying to reset what any of these agreements are. And it's lying to the American people. It is a lie to suggest that the NATO alliance comes into play at all in a situation where the United States, not having been attacked, has unilaterally gone to war with another country. The NATO alliance does not apply. And yet he's convinced millions of people by what he says when he's speaking or in his Truth Social. He is telling people that this is a failure of our NATO allies to abide by and keep their promise. And that is a lie. It's not true.
No, he was unable to justify this to the people at home and unable to justify this to our allies. And so, you know, you're right, there's nothing obliging the other countries in NATO to get behind whatever decision an authoritarian leader puts down. And Bill, you're right. Like, already we have lost so much credibility. We have become this unpredictable, wild country, right? So even if two-thirds of Congress does not vote us out of NATO or withdraw us from NATO, even still, you know, on a global, you know, our global reputation is ruined. You know, it's gone down the gutter, especially, you know, in the second presidency, or Trump's second presidency. Like, the first time we voted him in, okay, I imagine, you know, the world can look at us and say, well, that was an interesting choice, but maybe they'll learn their lesson. And now with the second time voting Trump in, what do we have to redeem, right? We you know, first was it first time it's oh gosh, what's that expression? First time
fool
like,
me once.
Fool me once. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's it. Yeah. So I guess we potentially could redeem ourselves if we do a kind of cleansing process, you know, like not only impeach him, but also like change our constitution to make sure nothing like that happens again. I don't know if that's feasible. But to Kathy's point, like I guess I don't know to what extent people have an understanding of what NATO is and what it means and whether they were convinced by his absolute false claims about what NATO is. I guess what I'm focused on is the world, the parties to the NATO treaty absolutely are, like, they know it's crazy talk for him to say that NATO is appropriate, that anything about NATO is invoked mm-hmm. when the U.S., you know, as a war of choice, starts bombing Iran. But on top of that, he has spent the last, well, it's unbelievable. It's only a year and a couple of months. He spent the entirety of his administration so far doing everything he can to destroy that alliance from within, you know, like threatening to take over Denmark, insulting the other leaders on a regular basis, bullying everybody. And so then he gets in a situation where it would be nice to have allies. And, like, that's a third reason. You know, like, the first right. reason is it's a bad idea to go uh-huh. to war. The second reason is that he's alienated all of his people. And the third reason is it has nothing to do with NATO and he shouldn't be invoking, you know, like.
But I think when you compare that to what George Bush did when he wanted to go to war in Iraq. First of all, he knew that was not in any way, shape, or form something that required the NATO alliance mm-hmm. to fight alongside him. This was, as we all know, a very bad decision ultimately, mm-hmm. Because for many reasons. But he negotiated with NATO members, and the UK provided support. There were some other members of NATO who agreed to provide support to the United States. But we had a president who clearly understood that was not a foregone conclusion, and it required diplomatic relations. It required sitting down and talking. It required a lot of work on his part to be able to build somewhat of an alliance so that it wasn't just the U.S. going it alone. And then ultimately, as things went sideways and very poorly in Iraq, even those friends, you know, extricated themselves even before the U.S. did. So, you know, I think that we have examples of doing this and doing it in a way that does not alienate our friends in NATO. But this president clearly has taken a different
his
path.
His strategy is just to throw a hissy fit
right.
and push us deeper into isolationism. But even then, we're not very. It's contradictory. It's like, you know, he's trying to make America an isolationist country, and at the same time, we're out there in everyone's business, joining hands with Israel to go after Iran.
So, something that it's important to be humble about history. Like, history plays jokes on us. And you just gave an example. The Iraq War was an example of a president who went through the process. Mm. He engaged the American public. He sold the idea of going to war to the American public. He went around, very carefully cultivated alliances. He built a whole coalition of people, of countries, important countries, countries that, you know, had major militaries and they were democracies. And they joined us in this effort. He made it a worldwide crusade, and it was a disaster. It was a terrible idea, even though the process in that situation, he followed the process. So following the process doesn't guarantee success.
Absolutely not. But it does, I think, result in what you I think have hit on in what you've said, sort of what is the aftermath of this going to be, right? And I think the aftermath of what was a very poor decision, ultimately, based on really bad intelligence, and some think faked intelligence, but the result of that was that we remained part of a world order that respected diplomacy, respected the United States,
and so we were still friends, right? Yeah.
And so now I think we are in a very different territory. But I agree. I wasn't suggesting that made Iraq a good idea. It was still a really bad idea, and yet
we
have a president who worked at it.
The other example of history playing a joke was, and this goes way back, but Ronald Reagan had this idea to do Star Wars. He was going to, like, put these satellites in outer space, and they were going to be able to shoot lasers and nuclear missiles so that it would protect the U.S. And at the time, that was kind of an unrealistic concept. But he was talking about it so much, and I think it was Mikhail Gorbachev thought to himself, oh, my God, the U.S. is going to spend a gazillion dollars. The Soviet Union at that point was already spending some an enormous amount of its economy on defense. Its economy was in tatters. It was, the communist system was kind of coming apart. And he's like, we cannot compete with what the U.S. is talking about doing. And that motivated him. So Reagan was crazy. The idea was crazy. It was never going to work. But the fact that he took it seriously motivated Gorbachev to come to the table. And it was kind of the first domino that fell that led to the Soviet Union coming apart. So history can play jokes. I just remember thinking when Reagan was pushing Star Wars, I was like, oh my God, he's going to blow up the world. He's going to destabilize the balance of power, nuclear, and it's going to be a mess. It ended up working out well in that case. So history plays jokes.
We will, jokes. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show. We thank you very much for being with us, and we'll come back for our last 10 minutes right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, and we wrap up the show this morning. And I wanted to talk about it. Kathy mentioned this earlier, and not this particularly, but about overall about affordability. And remember these things that come onto our radar. And one of the there's an opinion piece by Hillary Clinton in the New York Times today. How to fix affordability. And the former Secretary of State, U.S. Senator, and former First Lady of the United States talks in this about the new budget seeking $1.5 trillion for defense and enormous cuts to programs that help families struggling with the rising cost of living. Quote, we're fighting wars. We can't take care of daycare, he said at a private Easter lunch. She goes on to say this isn't surprising coming from a president who has dismissed America's affordability crisis as a hoax and a con job. For most parents, the crunch is all too real. Our kids will pay the price for the president's indifference. She goes on and talks about the various problems and what American families are facing. But she presents a what she calls a kids agenda that reflects what's already working with ideas that could be taken national to help more families. And she said, start with affordability. Parents today are navigating the highest costs in generation. Child care is one of the largest expenses most families face, while housing and diaper bills chip away at paychecks already stretched thin. For many mothers, income drops sharply right before and after having a child at the exact same time that costs surge. Mr. Trump's reckless war in Iran is making that pressure worse, driving up the price of gas, groceries, and other necessities. We know how to fix this. When the child tax credit was expanded in 2021, it led to the largest one-year drop in child poverty on record. States are building on that model, offering refundable tax credits and direct cash support on parents during pregnancy and early childhood. Illinois, Secretary Clinton writes, expanded its child tax credit to reach more low-income families and young children. In Michigan, a program called RX Kids provides direct payments to expectant mothers and to infants, which have led to fewer evictions, healthier births, and improved parental mental health. Programs like these should be expanded to other states. If we want to strengthen families, this is where we start, by helping parents stay afloat when a child arrives.
Well, it's ironic because when Trump was running both times, he was trying really hard to appeal to the working class. And then in office, he defunds a lot of social programs and safety nets like Medicaid, and then develops these other private market stuff like Trump RX, which actually doesn't save people all that much. When what we really need is something like a larger expanded public health care system. This president has presented himself as addressing issues of everyday Americans, but in practice, we haven't seen any of that.
When I think also, you know, part of this is a desire and, you know, the Republicans ran on this, but it's this idea of if we, you know, I talked about it a little bit, but you know, let's break everything. But it's let's break everything and then create an opportunity for the private sector mm-hmm. to come in and privatize what has historically been government functions. And so, you know, I think when you look at the opportunities for childcare, that was one area where I had some hope, right? Because that's not an area that government is heavily involved in. You know, there's Head Start, but mm-hmm. very low government involvement, opportunity for entrepreneurship, particularly among women and women-owned businesses. And so there was a real win-win opportunity there, in addition to freeing up more people for the workforce when you can find good daycare for your kids. So, you know, there seemed to be something there that both conservatives, you know, and liberals could find a way mm-hmm. of creating something really functional and helpful for working families. And we're not even talking about it. It's not even on the table. There have been no proposals. There's been no bipartisan legislation. There was an attempt to include daycare subsidies in the budget that dropped by the wayside because Republicans screamed about it. And so, you know, here we are with nothing to show for it. And again, I think it's an area where there's such an opportunity because of who benefits from just focusing on high quality daycare for our kids, that we should be doing it, and we're not.
And the private market is not going to help us achieve this, right? That is, privatizing things means making sure these products are profitable, right? It's not charitable. It's not improving the social safety net at all. What we need are better social programs. And that is so far down the list right now because of all the disasters that we're all the big fires that we're trying to put out.
So. All right, Bill, you get the last word.
I want people to have kids. I want having kids to be easier. I want to encourage that, and I do think government has a role in providing support for young families. I guess I'm leery of having so when government gets involved. You want to talk about affordability? You have a regulatory structure that goes with that. You have wage rules. You have limits on, you have standards for who can be hired. And those things tend to drive up the costs. And then the government comes in with subsidies to pay those higher costs. You can get into a spiral that leads to less affordability. But I do think that I think the way to do it is with things like tax credits. I actually think there should be a partnership where the government is putting up money and the private sector is providing the service. That would be the approach that I think would work best.
We are out of time, but I want to thank our wonderful panel for being with us this morning. Thanks to all of you for listening. A reminder, the roundtable will be on the road at Frederick Church's Owana on Monday, May 4th. You can find out about tickets by going to wamc.org/on the road. WAMC.org on the road. They are selling very briskly, so if you want in, please do so. And thank you all very much. Always a pleasure to have you as a part of the program. We will continue this very show right after these announcements.